people definitely resonate with that notion that once they have an element of control, they're more interested in having more control over their energy future.
Hey, welcome back to the third episode of Building Local Power from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Today, we're talking with John Farrell, the director of our Energy Democracy Program. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
And I'm Chris Mitchell, the guy who heads the our internet-related program, the Community Broadband Networks Initiative, or program, depending on how I feel like describing it in a given day. But today, we're going to talk about energy democracy. John, you've just released a new report talking about economies of scale. We're going to get into that, but let's first start with a general question. For people that are interested in building local power, making sure that their community's empowered to make their own decisions, why should they care where their electricity comes from?
Well, there's a huge opportunity, and you think about it in the big scale here. We spend collectively in this country about $360 billion a year on electricity. And the technology in the electricity system is changing so fast to allow us more and more control over that at a local level, whether that's rooftop solar or the fact that I can sit here on my couch and control my thermostat from my smartphone, or the rising prevalence of electric vehicles and the fact that those batteries can both take energy from the grid but also give it back to the grid. We just have so many different ways in which we have local control possible thanks to technology and the fact that it's becoming cost effective that it really changes the whole dynamic of the system. And it's a really important place for us to look. And even more important than that, electricity is so exciting because it's basically the only kind of energy source that we have, not that we can actually make renewable, that we can make clean. We know with the wind and the sun that we have cost-effective alternatives to fossil fuels. And so whether it's from a local control standpoint or the economic opportunities or from the environmental standpoint, electricity is really an exciting place to play.
Let's talk about the newer report that you've done, which actually, it seems to me, this is a continuation of some of the work you did when you first started at ILSR. And it's worth noting, I think our energy program is one of the longest running efforts that the Institute has been involved with. But tell us what the new report is all about.
Well, the report was intended in some ways as an update. You're right. In 2008, we examined the economies of scale in wind energy production and also in ethanol, basically to look at this question of, is bigger best? Because there is this conventional wisdom that bigger size things are more economically efficient. And that persists throughout our economy, but also in energy. And it was true for a very long time, for decades, in fact, in the electricity industry, that the bigger you built the power plant, the more energy you could get out of it at a lower cost per unit. And that myth kind of persisted into renewable energy, even though renewable energy like wind and solar is really very different. The power plant that you build that's 500 megawatts or 1,000 megawatts that can serve hundreds of thousands of homes is kind of one big built custom unit when you're talking about fossil fuel generation. When you're talking about renewable energy, though, we're talking about modular systems. So an individual wind turbine only powers maybe 500 homes. An individual solar panel only produces a couple hundred watts, enough to run your toaster or something like that. And so when you build a big power plant, you just build lots of them. And so we have this enormous opportunity with renewable energy to build things at a smaller scale, because we don't need to have 100 or 1,000 or 500,000 of these units in order to make a power plant. We only need a handful of them. So you can build a couple of wind turbines and have it power a small community. You can build a solar array on a rooftop and have it power that home. And so that's really the opportunity provided by the technology. And what we were investigating in our report then was this question of whether or not it's cost effective, in fact, to do so at a smaller scale versus doing so at a large scale.
I feel like when you say cost effective, I have to wonder where we're going to draw the boundaries, because it might be, if you just look at the cost per watt produced, that might be one thing. But how do you count in the reliability that comes from having multiple points of electricity production scattered around, so they're not likely to be disrupted by a single tornado or hurricane or earthquake? Did you wrestle with issues around that, of where you just draw the boundary of what costs are relevant?
We didn't wrestle with that particular issue in the report, although I appreciate you mentioning it, because, for example, utilities are required to have a reserve. So the regional management of our grid system, the regional managers say to all the utilities, you have to have as a reserve basically a duplicate of your largest size power plant plus a safety margin to take into account that issue of when you lose, you know, say, let's say that biggest power plant goes out plus another transmission line goes out and limits the amount of power you have available on your system. And it's funny because that reserve margin is directly related to the scale of the system. If you didn't have large power plants, then your reserve requirements would be relatively low because it would take a lot more disruption in order to turn off a lot of your power plants. But to be fair, we didn't wrestle with that particular issue, although it is an important one in renewable energy in particular, because the more you spread out, the less variable it is. You know, with one solar panel on my home rooftop, if it gets cloudy right over my home, the power output from that solar panel drops dramatically. But if we have solar power panels spread out all over a metropolitan area, for example, on a partly cloudy day, it's unlikely that all of them are going to be clouded at the same time. And so the system can be more adaptable. But to get to the point in terms of where you draw the line, what we really did that is different than what other folks do is we did extend the line to talk about how much does it cost to bring that power to the point where we use it. Because most of the analyses that look at this issue of whether bigger is better say, oh, well, that really huge power plant we can build out in the desert for solar, you know, it only costs half as much per kilowatt hour as it does to generate solar on a home rooftop. But it sort of ignores the fact that nobody's out in a remote area of the California desert charging their iPhone, right? We're doing that in our homes and in our businesses. And so what we tried to do was to take into account that delivery problem, both in terms of building the infrastructure to make that delivery and the losses of energy that you have when you try to send it long distance.
And so I'm sitting at the edge of my seat. What's the result? Is it better to have those giant plants out there in Nevada or in California, or is it better to distribute it?
So the answer is it depends a little bit. So we looked both at wind energy and at solar energy. What we found, if you look just at where that energy is generated, is that the difference between a very small wind power plant with maybe like 3 or 4 turbines and the really big ones is about a 16% lower cost of energy if you build it really far away. But that there are transmission costs that add a significant amount of cost to your project in terms of going long distance. And so what we found was kind of an approximation is the best we could do. But if your wind power project is more than, say, about 400 miles away from the city where you're going to be using the energy, it's probably not going to pay off to try to go seek either that better wind resource or build that bigger project than it would. And instead, it would be better to build that project locally and at a smaller scale that you could make up that transmission difference. And we actually have a map in the report that kind of looks at this with some concrete examples, whether that's Minneapolis or Chicago or New York City, and just gives you a sense of what those costs are for those that kind of distance to travel and where it actually ends up being more cost effective to generate closer to home. With solar energy, it even gets a little bit more complicated in the sense that, and this is where this analysis starts to get, I think, really into the important piece, which is it's not really an apples to apples comparison, because that power plant that's out in the desert, that solar power plant that's really large and out in the desert, is going to compete in the wholesale market. They're selling energy into this big regional market, and they're competing with all the other kind of stuff, coal power plants, natural gas power plants, what have you. But the solar on the rooftop's really competing with whatever it is, whatever the price it is that the utility charges that ultimate customer. You know, when I put solar on my own roof, I'm just reducing my energy load. I'm reducing my energy bill. And that price is a lot higher than out on the wholesale market when it doesn't take into account all those delivery charges. So there's a couple things here. One is, yeah, you could get cheaper electricity even with transmission from a solar project delivered into an urban area, maybe, but the point is that it's not competing with the same energy costs as that rooftop solar project. And so what we really found was that solar is competitive just about anywhere. That if you build it out in the desert and at large scale, it competes on the wholesale market. If you build it on a commercial rooftop, on the top of a warehouse or on top of a retail store, it competes with the commercial retail energy price. And if you put it on a home rooftop, it competes with that energy price as well. So and I think that's the most important thing, is to say it's going to compete everywhere, that no matter where we put it, the energy that it generates is going to be more valuable than the energy cost, than the energy that we pay for at that location.
Is it even the right question to be asking in terms of whether things are cost comparative today when we're talking about building a new facility? I mean, if you put a panel for solar photovoltaic on your roof, it's going to last 20 or 30 years. If you build a new coal plant, it's going to be 50, 70 years, I'm guessing. So to some extent, isn't there a forecasting element to this?
Absolutely. So when we compare in our report, like the price of the large scale wind and solar systems, we don't compare to what the price is on the grid now from these, you know, old fossil fuel plants that are paid off, but that will also have to retire relatively soon, many of them. We instead compare that to what does it cost to build a new power plant, like a new natural gas power plant, since we're not building a lot of coal, thankfully. And that's the price that we find appropriate to compete against. When we talk about rooftop solar, though, we're still really only talking about that issue of what's the price to deliver energy. You know, I pay, like, you know, in Minneapolis, 11 or 12 cents for every kilowatt hour of energy that I consume from Xcel Energy, the electric utility. So that's the price of the competition. This price of the new natural gas power plant, you know, producing energy wherever it is on the grid that it plugs in, is more like 6 or 7 cents a kilowatt hour. And that's what that large scale solar has to compete against.
So you and I were in grad school together, where you first became acquainted with my loud mouth. But one of the things that I remember from an energy course is the psychological impact from having a solar panel on your rooftop. It makes you think differently. It might make you more willing to get up and turn that light off that you're not using because you're thinking about where it's produced, whereas your neighbor might be just using power that comes from, you know, Manitoba's hydroelectric dams or a nuclear power plant that's really far away, and they don't really see themselves as having a relationship to it. And so I'm curious about the democracy part of your energy democracy program. How does that really play into the electricity production in the United States?
Well, it really is a sea change in the sort of culture of energy, that we have traditionally had these large companies that produce energy for us, and that we are simply customers, and that our only job in terms of managing our energy consumption is to try to use less. What's really happening in recent years is that we're seeing a transition in the sort of rules of the system, where regulators are saying, you know what, we need to focus more on energy efficiency and conservation because those are the cheapest ways to get more energy for the whole system. But we're also seeing more, like you point out, of people thinking about the fact that now that we have the technology at our fingertips, now that we can be producers, we want to have a lot more control and say over the system. So say in Boulder, Colorado, for example, the city there has now been in about a 5-year battle with the incumbent electric utility over wanting to have more say in its energy future on behalf of a lot of customers who have solar themselves, who are saying, look, I individually can make this decision to reduce my reliance on the incumbent electric utility. And our community wants to do that as well, because there's all these economic benefits and spillover benefits that have nothing to do with energy, but everything to do with kind of the future and the resilience of my local economy that can come from this. And a perfect illustration of this is something like 30 or 40% of electric car owners served by the San Diego Gas and Electric Utility in Southern California also have solar power. You know, they look at this, they went out, they bought the car, and they realized, hey, rather than charging this from the utility's dirty power plants, I can own my own solar panel and I can charge from that. I can further reduce my transportation costs by generating the energy I use to put into my car. So people definitely resonate with that notion that once they have an element of control, they're more interested in having more control over their energy future.
And let's talk quickly about what I sometimes think of as the big guys, the big incumbent interests. Do they make more money from large central production generation facilities than they would from a grid that is more distributed?
Well, it's important to kind of draw a line here and divide. There's sort of two kinds of utilities. You have rural electric cooperatives and municipal utilities, which are effectively owned by their customers. So there's no profit motive here, but there is kind of a cultural dependence on large-scale power generation. Sort of the relationship, most cities, for example, that have their own utility are part of a larger network of power purchasers and power plant operators, and they all buy from the same people. And so they're kind of stuck in this paradigm of, well, we've always bought power from these guys, and they're the ones who make the power plant decisions, and they like building big things. So that's kind of the nature of that relationship. With the other kind of utilities, we have what are called investor-owned utilities. Those are for-profit private companies. In many cases, and probably in most states now, but about 30 states, they're what are called regulated monopolies. So they have control over all of their customers. There's no alternative supplier. They make money in two ways. One is selling more electricity, although some recent laws have kind of tweaked that to allow them to make some money even when they are encouraging conservation. They really make their most money and their return on investment when they spend their own money, when they spend their own capital. And big utilities don't like to build small things. They like to build big things. So there's a definite bias toward building big from investor-owned utilities, because that's where they're going to make their return on investment. You know, they're going to build, for example, in Minnesota, the utility was recently trying to replace a very large coal power plant with about 700 megawatts of natural gas generation. And they want to own that themselves, of course, because when they build that and own it themselves, however many millions or billions of dollars that costs, they're going to get about 10% of that back for their shareholders.
John, one of the things that I hear, and I sometimes think of this as, you know, your uncle at Thanksgiving, when you're talking about these sorts of issues, will say, yeah, well, Germany, they have all this renewable energy and it's a disaster. They're just buying all this coal now and their prices are outrageous and it's a horrible, horrible disaster. You talked about Germany in your report. What's going on there?
Well, there's a lot of different pieces to this sort of Germany is bad, or this, you know, doubling down on renewables is bad myth about Germany. What I think is important to understand, first of all, is that they have a term for what they've been doing in Germany. They call it Energiewende, which means, and I apologize, my German language skills are very limited, so I probably mispronounced that horribly, but the basic concept is that word means energy change.
Just to be very clear for people who might not be familiar, what's the 30-second thumbnail sketch of what Germany's actually done?
Germany has built more renewable energy and gets more of its electricity from renewable resources than just about any other country in the world. And they did this through kind of a crash plan in terms of investment in both wind and solar energy over the past 15 to 20 years. Germany is doing this from a standpoint of both changing their energy supply to renewable energy resources and also doing it in terms of changing the ownership of those resources. So I did a comparison in the report, for example. In a similar five-year period, both Germany and the U.S. installed about 22 gigawatts of solar, 22,000 megawatts of solar. But there was a huge difference in the way that they deployed that. So in Germany, three-quarters of those projects were smaller than 500 kilowatts, which, for example, is the roof of a fairly sizable retail store. In the United States, it was less than half of those projects, solar projects, were smaller than a megawatt, which would be like a big box store, like an IKEA, for example. So way more of the solar that Germany built was built at a small scale. There were some policy differences about like what drove that development, but the idea was, let's spread this around to everybody. Let's let everybody make a return on investment in this switch over to solar. They also had a similar commitment in wind power. So there's that piece of it that I think is crucially important, is that they don't just look at this the standpoint of the cost of the energy, but they look at it in terms of like the overall benefit to the economy and to the people. And so millions of Germans are owners in solar individually, or they're part of wind cooperatives or energy cooperatives that are financially benefiting from this transition that is much more than just the cost of electricity. I think a second issue that's important to address with Germany, because it comes up a lot, is this issue of cost. Yes, because of taxes, Germans pay about twice as much per kilowatt hour of electricity as we do here in the United States, sometimes even three times as much. But what's important to understand is that Germans only pay about the same amount per bill as we do, about $100 a month, as we do in the United States, because they've learned to use less. They have tools available to them, like solar, to reduce their energy consumption. So it's not that it is much more costly in Germany, it's that they have a lot of different ways to help reduce their bill, and giving customers that control is a huge piece of this energy democracy movement in the United States as well.
I think it's also worth noting that they have metric hours over there, so it's a totally different system.
Right.
I want to conclude with a question as to a recommendation that you can offer for an article or a book that you've recently read that just piqued your interest and you think people should hear about.
You know, that's a really great question. I guess what I would say is basically anything that David Roberts over at Vox writes. He is a really insightful writer. He gives, I think, really excellent perspective on the change in the energy system, but he also occasionally dives into some really fascinating pieces on politics and the psychology of both energy and politics. The article that was most interesting to me recently was one that he wrote about kind of Donald Trump's relationship with the truth, and about he has just kind of a different perspective on truth than most Americans do. Which I thought was really interesting. It wasn't a critique per se. It was just sort of an acknowledgement that he sort of operates in a very different way than most of us do with that relationship. But I find it he's very insightful, whether it's he's writing about politics or energy. And so very much enjoy his work.
Great. And he was, I remember his name, when he was with Grist before, wasn't he?
Yeah. He left Grist for Vox a few years ago, but has been doing very similar and excellent work at Vox since then.
Great. Well, thank you for talking about these issues with us, and we'll hear back from you in a few months, I'm guessing.
Sounds good. Thanks, Chris.
That was John Farrell, director of the Energy Democracy Program here at ILSR, visiting with Chris Mitchell for episode number 3 of our Building Local Power podcast. To download John's new report, visit ILSR.org, where you can also sign up for updates on the Energy Democracy Program, and you can check out the latest updates from John. In addition to reports, he regularly publishes articles on the Energy Self-Reliant States blog, and he interviews guests for the Local Energy Rules podcast. In fact, you can subscribe to this podcast and all of the podcasts in the ILSR podcast family on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts from. Never miss out on our original research by also subscribing to our monthly newsletter. You can also do that at ILSR.org. Thanks to Dysfunction Al for the music licensed through Creative Commons. The song is Funk Interlude. This is Lisa Gonzalez from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Thanks again for listening to the Building Local Power podcast.